That'll be your assignment for the next time. I'd like to have you read the section on penance, and that will be your quiz in the Catholic Catechism. So pages 481 up to 499. 481 to 499. In fact, 500. Pardon me. So 481 to 500. Those pages in your quiz will be on the sacrament of penance. Okay. Secondly, I'd like to have you read three documents of the Holy Father on religious life, but you will not be held responsible in a quiz. These are from his talks in France and Brazil. In the collection of his talks in France, it is on page 56. The Holy Father met a numerous representation of women religious in the chapel of the Miraculous Medal, and he gave them the following talk. It's on the imitation of Christ. So page 56, I don't like to tell you where it ends because you keep thinking I'm giving you a lot of work. Page 56 to 61. And in the same lectures that he gave, or conferences that he gave, this was to the Carmelites at Lisieux. Again, in the same volume, pages 229 and 230. So those two. Then, in the talks that he gave in Brazil, pages 136 to 146. Oh, pardon me. This is starting at page 136. This is a lot. There are a number of big pictures in between, though. Page 136 to 168. So 136 to 168 in his talks in Brazil. I thought I should give you them both. The first, there are two talks, one to women religious and the other to men religious. Are we clear then? So two talks that he gave in France and two in Brazil. All four to religious, your reading assignment. I think I will ask you to let me know in your quiz or on your quiz that you have read these four talks. Please? You will not be asked questions. I will just ask you whether you've read them. So, once more, the your reading and the quiz is pages 481 to 500 on the Sacrament of Penance, on which you will be quizzed, and then those two sections from his talks, both in France and Brazil, to both men and women religious, for which you will not be held responsible in written form, but I'm asking you to read. Okay. Some have asked me regarding the documentation from the Holy See. I understand the documents are finished, but we have not received any of them, have we? On formation, on religious and political matters, and on contemplation or prayer in the religious life. And all the evidence that I'm getting is the Code of Canon Law will be out in 1981. I might also mention that, as you probably know, the Catholic Voice of America, with which I have been involved, has entered into a contractual arrangement with Mother Angelica, the Poor Clare Abbess in Alabama, and through her we've just got the satellite license Monday of this week, the first satellite license to a Catholic organization in the country, and planning to start the 1st of June. And one of my main purposes in working as I have for the last 15 years to get the church involved in the media is to make sure that religious, good religious, be able to use the media for teaching and for communicating what, as religious, we believe in. Because so much of the religious life, I think, has been suffering because of the very bad image of religious life in a country like ours. One more definition of Trent before we go into modern times. Among other significant definitions was this unusual one, declaring that masses at which the priest alone communicates are valid and licit. Evidently, this is to bring out the fact that a mass is pleasing to God and effective in communicating grace, even though no congregation is there. Again, because of the Protestants, for whom the congregation makes the Eucharistic liturgy, and is their presence that really forms or constitutes the liturgy. That is not Catholic teaching. Now, before we leave the subject of the Mass, I think I should, and I ask this to be left on the board, bring out something that might otherwise be missed. This is with respect to the relationship between the Mass and Calvary. May I first ask a couple of questions? On Calvary, did Christ redeem the world? On Calvary, did Christ obtain the grace that we need to be redeemed?
Yes.
Now, a more difficult question. If Calvary obtained for the world the graces we need to be saved, what function does the Mass, or do Masses serve? How can we both legitimately and intelligibly say that the Mass is the sacrifice of Calvary if, it would seem, the world was redeemed on the cross? Either the world was redeemed on the cross or it wasn't. If it wasn't, then everything St. Paul says is wrong. If it was sufficient, then what possible purpose, except as a dramatic commemoration, what possible value is there in the Mass? Beverly.
When you attend Mass, that's where you receive the grace was given on Calvary, but that's how you receive it, through the Mass.
All right. So through the Mass, what does Calvary do? He does not merit the grace.
It distributes,
communicates. The official verb of the church is dispense. Christ dispenses the graces of Calvary mainly through the Mass. But let's pass a little further. If it is through the Mass, not only, but mainly through the Mass, the graces of Calvary are dispensed, well, except for being dispensed, where do we come in? Are we simply and merely the beneficiaries? What is our role in the dispensation of that grace? It would seem, all right, Christ died on the cross. Through the Mass, he principally distributes or dispenses the grace. So each gets our share. 4 billion people in the world, each of us gets 1/4 billionth, mathematically speaking, of the graces won for us on the cross. You get your share, and I hope I get mine. Is that all?
Well, St. Paul says, I fill up what is wanting to the sufferings of Christ. So we are channels of that grace. It is up to us to pray, to intercede for, to bring the grace to others.
All right. The Mass is the means of communicating or dispensing the grace. Consequently, we use two verbs. The Mass determines the communication. Except for the Mass, the graces in large measure would not be communicated. But we condition that dispensation. Notice we don't determine it. We condition it. And these are technical words. Note the difference. It is from Calvary through the Mass that salvation is effected. But is it possible for one of these 4 billion people in the world to get little or no grace from Calvary through the Mass? We condition. We don't like to use the word determine. You get the distinction? It is through the Mass, but conditioned on, dependent on, our what?
Our disposition.
At any given moment, somewhere upwards of 400,000 Masses, yeah, in a given day, about 400,000 Masses are being offered. At any given moment, perhaps several thousand Masses are being offered. Grace is being dispensed. How much grace do I receive? It depends on my disposition. Because note, what we had earlier regarding the Eucharist as presence, sacrifice, and communion, being at once a form of worship and a sacrament. Sacrament means a channel of grace. But while the sacraments give the grace, what Latin phrase do we use to describe the giving of the grace? Ex opere operato. Ex opere operato means, just because Mass is said, therefore grace is dispensed. But how much grace is received by any individual depends first on the condition of the whole mystical body. The holier the mystical body is at any given moment, the more effective is every Mass being offered, and especially depending on the moral dispositions, the detachment from creatures, the spirit of prayer and sacrifice, the sinlessness. The more sinless a person is, the more grace they receive. All right? And it is there especially that the bloody character of the Mass on our side comes in. The more blood-stained we are, with apologies for the figurative speech, the more grace we receive. In other words, either we duplicate in our lives something of the sacrifice of Christ in his passion and death, or we do not benefit from Calvary, even though the graces are being dispensed. Right? Now some development of doctrine over the centuries. I would like to say something first about the reservation of the Blessed Sacrament. How soon was the Blessed Sacrament reserved from already the first century? Various saints, Saint Cyprian, for example, in Basil, 2nd and 3rd centuries, refer to the reservation of the Holy Eucharist. Again, when Holy Communion became frequent, but Mass, especially because of persecution, more difficult, the faithful kept the Blessed Sacrament in their homes or carried it on their persons. Not uncommon. Who knows the name of a famous child martyr who carried the Blessed Sacrament? Tarsicius. Hermits from the earliest times who lived far from the cities kept the Blessed Sacrament up to the 13th and 14th centuries, so that we can safely say from the very beginning, those who call themselves religious, even as hermits, first reserved the Holy Eucharist. From the year 313, churches as we know them became common. Why? Because until 313, the church was not free to build churches out in the open. And the ordinary place of reservation from the time of persecution was, and to this day remains, the church. The reservation of the Blessed Sacrament under the species of bread has been customary from the very beginning, although in some places, though the church does not now canonically permit it, the Blessed Sacrament was, the host was dipped into the consecrated chalice, and the dipped host would be reserved. This is no longer permitted by the Church's general reservation. When did the modern devotion to the reserved Eucharist really begin? It began with the early heresies. We saw some of them, didn't we? Would anybody remember even the name of one heretic who denied the real presence? Baron Garius. Thank you. So the modern devotion to the real presence began with the denial of the real presence. The Feast of Corpus Christi was instituted in order to meet the challenge of the heresies in the 13th century. Who knows what happened to the Feast of the Precious Blood? Yes. You look it up in your missal, or if the complete list of all the feasts for the year is in your divine office, you will see it is no longer Corpus Christi. It is now Corpus et Sanguis Christi. It is the feast of the body and blood of Christ. Okay. The Feast of Corpus Christi, just for the record, was instituted by Pope Urban VI, date 1264. Now something about the history of frequent communion up to modern times. I think it bears emphasis especially to religious and religious-to-be, because without Holy Communion, there would be no religious life. In plain English, we couldn't take it. In the early church, daily communion was the common practice. If you can get your hands on a copy, by the way, it might be worth my doing this if you wish. I think it's a 48-page article published on the 50th anniversary of the Decree on Frequent Communion of Pope St. Pius X in Theological Studies. It's about a 40-some page article on the history of frequent communion. Fascinating. I might bring a copy. Sister, you might remind me, and copies could be maybe photographed if you're interested. The early church, therefore, daily communion was the common practice. As the church became soft, and you know what softened the church? One guess. The cessation of persecution. Again, when I visited Bishop Gutke in Gary, I rang the doorbell, and a young nun answered the door, and I thought I was in the wrong place. I didn't have the nerve to ask her, "What are you doing here?" But I asked, "Is this the bishop's residence?" She said, "Yes." He has sisters from Krakow taking care of the Episcopal rector. They are the Albertine sisters, dressed in full habits, and I mean full habits. They were sent to the Gary Diocese by the then Cardinal Archbishop of Krakow. He told his good friend, Bishop Gutke, "I want these sisters to be in America." I think there are 9 of them. I'd like to bring them here sometime. They know the Pope very well personally, and they're learning English rapidly. In any case, the breakdown of frequent communion began with a breakdown of a strong religious life among all the people. And that's why Poland, as you probably know today, is the one country which, percentage-wise, has the largest number of vocations in the world. Of the 70 Jesuit provinces in the world, the 2 with the largest number of vocations are the 2 provinces of Poland. persecution works. The secret is to know you're being persecuted. You've got to know that. Do you know we're being persecuted here?
Yes.
Some people call persecution adaptation to modern culture. And they love it. That's why the church is in trouble. As a consequence, by 1215, at the Fourth Council of the Lateran, at the Fourth Lateran Council, it was decreed that every person, on reaching the age of reason, must receive two sacraments of penance and Holy Eucharist. And that, in fact, under penalty of excommunication. How often? At least when? During the Easter season or the Paschal season. Not much happened in spite of that decree. People were neglecting frequent communion. Just three examples of the condition between 1215 and the Council of Trent. St. Thomas said that a person could receive even daily, but they had to have extraordinarily good dispositions. St. Bonaventure said the same thing. Sometime out of curiosity, if you haven't read this yet, read those pages in the Imitation of Christ on communion. Remember? If you want to go to communion every day, fine, but you better be holy. So much so that already into the 20th century, as you know, many people did not receive communion often. The Council of Trent strongly urged all the faithful to receive communion every day. St. Ignatius, who read that, ordered the Society of Jesus to promote daily communion. In more than one diocese, we were penalized by the local chancery for preaching and encouraging daily communion. The main reason, of course, as you know, is because Jansenism came into existence shortly after the Protestant Reformation. The Jansenists claimed a person should not receive communion unless he or she were totally detached from all sinful, even venial occasions to sin. These people were debarred from receiving communion. Married people could not go to communion unless he had gone to confession after having marital intercourse. Businessmen, people engaged in politics, were debarred from communion. One result was that religious communities were known to have sisters, for example, who made their first communion on their deathbed. The great defender of the Council of Trent against the Jansenists on this matter was Saint Vincent de Paul. At any rate, it took Saint Pius X to restore frequent communion to the Catholic Church. What is the teaching of Saint Pius X on frequent communion. First, frequent communion, said Pope Pius X, means daily communion. Second, daily communion is commendable for all. Third, the dispositions required for communion are only two. First, the state of grace, and secondly, the right intention. By right intention, that I don't go out of either vanity or some other less laudable motive, but to obtain God's grace. And then most importantly, the primary purpose of communion is not to safeguard Christ's honor or as a reward for virtue, which was the teaching of the Jansenists. The primary purpose is to obtain strength to avoid sin and indeed to remove sin, because Holy Communion removes guilt and punishment of venial sin. Any further questions? How far do we go? How long do we go?
Quarter to.
Please?
Quarter to
3:45.
Is this? Is it Mass at 4? Well, I guess that's it. I gave you your assignment, and I was reminded when to stop. So let's pray. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit.
Full of grace, the Lord is with thee. Blessed art thou among women, and blessed is the fruit of thy womb, Jesus. Holy Mary, Mother of God, pray for us sinners, now and at the hour of our death. Amen.
O Mary, conceived without sin,
pray for us who have recourse to thee.
In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Amen.
The Sunday classes begin here. Moral theology and the liturgy.
Yeah. Those are rather precarious seats there. My apologies for the delay. After the Mass, I got my breakfast, so I was told to get those things. Then this evening, I leave at 5:30. My plane leaves at 5:30 for Washington. And consequently, the plan is that we'll go until 4:30, but to make sure that we don't waste any time, you will get your quiz at 4:30. And Father Downey is coming in to offer the benediction and have Vespers with you. I might make a couple of announcements. I'm not sure whether I told you that our Catholic Voice of America was hoping to get a satellite license. We got it last Monday, the first Catholic license for a satellite in the United States. And we plan to start using the media for catechesis for teaching religious education by the 1st of June. We have two communities in the East that are going to work with us, have agreed contractually, Mother Claudia's community and the Sisters of Charity, Mother of the Word, in Baltic, Connecticut. Mother Angelica called from Alabama last night and she said, they've almost signed the contract, I think I mentioned to you, having the Holy Father signing a 52-week contract to have him on the air every week, broadcasting his Wednesday audiences. The cost is $1,000 a week, which we are approaching the Knights of Columbus. We are confident they will have no difficulty getting the $70,000 which it will need to have the Holy Father on the air weekly. Well, regarding, I suppose, sorry to say, there have been no physical miracles among the five that you've been praying for. We ask you to continue your prayers, but Sean Bolin, the first of those listed with multiple sclerosis, that is, degenerating him, so his mother, he's 24 years old, now has to feed him. He's quite paralyzed. She tells me that a miracle happened in that he is totally resigned to God's will. At any rate, do keep praying, because the Daughters of St. Paul would like to have a blessed for their foundress and, naturally, the people who are asking for the miracle would like to be cured. Your quiz will be on the questions, I believe, something like 113 to... At any rate, we will cover the material from question 81 on. And as we have been doing, in most cases you have only a very short reply on which I will then make a brief comment. Question 81, 82, 83, and 84 pretty much have to do with the same subject, namely pride. As I've been doing so far, and I intend to lump a number of questions together, make a comment either on an individual question or on a cluster of questions, rather than take each one singly because of the sheer amount of matter that needs to be covered. We might first note that pride, although it is listed as the first of the seven capital sins, is also often considered the first and principal sin from which all others derive. Because whatever else pride is, it is not only an inordinate desire for one's own excellence, but a false or untrue belief in one's own independence. Pride is essentially the sin of independence or autonomy, even to being independent of God. There is, as you know, what may be called a justifiable pride, though it, of course, is no longer a sin when it is justifiable. As humility is truth, so pride is the untruth. There is nothing wrong with recognizing one's excellence, whether natural or supernatural. It becomes wrong when I consider myself either superior to others because I have what they don't have, where the essence of the sin consists in my believing that what I have is my own. The essence of pride is considering that what I have belongs to me, that it is not a gift from God. And consequently, a proud person considering him or herself better than someone else, the essence of the sin of pride is not in my considering that I, for example, have more education than somebody else. I've had 31 years. I don't boast about it. There was one person, when I mentioned this in public, asked me in public, "Did you need it?" Well, frankly, yes. So it's not pride, sinful pride, when I recognize that I have what somebody else doesn't have. I've corrected enough papers, I've examined enough students to know that not all students are equally intelligent. It is not pride, and this is not unimportant, to recognize that I have what somebody else does not have. The essence of pride is taking, as we say, pride in what I have as though it's my own. Now, the worst pride, and the foundation of all sin, is considering what I have as my own in such a way that I will not submit myself to God in what He wants me to submit myself to. The most sinful pride is to think that I have my own will as the essence of humility, is recognizing that even my will is not my own. That while I am physically free to use it as I want, I am not morally free to use it as I wish. What is the remedy for pride? Clearly, all pride is founded on some falsehood. And consequently, I begin to recognize who I am, first with respect to God, and then with respect to others, by having a true knowledge of myself, which I consider the most difficult knowledge to acquire. True self-knowledge is the hardest to acquire. Because we are naturally prone to think of ourselves as more and better than we are. These seven capital sins, as we've been saying, are natural because we have a fallen human nature and we have seven wrong tendencies, of which the first, not only because it's listed first, but the most fundamental is pride. In the practical order, God, who wants to make sure that we will not be proud, sends us humiliations. There is no other way known to God or man of growing in humility, which is the opposite of pride, than humiliation. There are humiliations that are built into our nature. The humiliation of having to, pardon me, eat more or less three times a day. To open an orifice called the mouth and to put, well, bits of dead animal flesh and the leavings of what is called vegetation, and to open this orifice and put it inside what is called the mouth. And unless we do, like the beasts of the field, they chew their cud and we chew our food. We have to go to sleep more or less, depending on your habits, 6-7 hours a day. I think there is nothing more humiliating than to see, for example, on the plane, a well-dressed executive, perhaps chairman of the board, on his way to a corporation meeting where he will decide on the destiny, perhaps, of hundreds of thousands of people, slumped in his plain seat, dead, asleep. The child I baptized this morning didn't like the water. To recall that each one of us was a crying, my mother told me, screaming, helpless babe. God sends us humiliations. That's life. Without humiliations, nobody becomes humble. All right? And the only trouble with so many people is they resist God's effort to overcome their pride. Vainglory is in a class by itself. You might say vainglory is cheap pride. There is a pride. Now, if it's sinful, it's never legitimate. But gifted people, intelligent people, people with so many qualities of nature or grace, you almost want to excuse their pride. But when people don't have much to be proud of, that's vainglory. After 20 years of teaching this, this is my homemade definition of vainglory. A person who has no authority, except what has been delegated to him, for example, to say, well, guard the gates in the airport. Not even a ticket agent. But as you know, there is no one who can be, I don't say they are, but no one who is more vain than, as I've watched, standing outside the plush apartment buildings on Park Avenue, studded with buttons, looking the world in the eye, the doorman. You know what I'm saying? At any rate, vainglory is all those thousands of things to which we are all prone, being proud of things that would be ridiculous if they were not so pathetic. Any questions on pride? A rich subject, and we need, all of us, to be told it's a sin. Avarice, questions 85, 86, and 87. A synonym, yes, brother?
Mean to say also, like if you do something, I don't know if it's right, but if you feel good about it, that's wrong too?
Well, it all depends on how good you feel.
Usually I do feel good.
Or isn't that the proper definition of happiness?
Well, it depends. There was a little book that I'd commend to all of you. I'm sure it's out of print. It's by St. Vincent Ferrer, the Dominican preacher. And the book is on Christian perfection, which of course is the title of many books. But this is extraordinary. He was no theologian, but he was a very down-to-earth, practical man of God. This is answering your question, brother. As a person grows in sanctity, you might almost say that growth in sanctity is a decrease in self-esteem, of course it is legitimate, disesteem of self. But Vincent Ferrer points out that while it can be legitimate for me to have something or to know something or be capable of something which others are not, there is no sin in recognizing, say, that I have what someone else does not have, because it may be the truth. But as a person grows in holiness, and say the person does possess some virtue, whatever the virtue may be, or a person has done something which is creditable, Vincent says, we grow in humility in the degree to which we dissociate ourselves from whatever good we either have or do. In other words, that we never for a moment, and his advice is for a moment, credit ourselves for anything independently of God. That's one reason, and I may have mentioned this before, but if I haven't, it's worth mentioning. I do, as you know, a good deal of publication. If I read, and sometimes I do, open one of my books, unless I have a good reason for looking something up, I confess having read my publications. Does that help, brother? Because there are things I have to look up. For example, I am currently publishing a question and answer catechism for Doubleday. We're up to 1,700 questions and answers, not finished yet. That's a lot of questions and answers. I do need to consult what I have published elsewhere to refresh my memory. That's a legitimate reason for opening, say, the dictionary. Am I making sense?
Yeah.
I couldn't be more personal, but I want to be helpful. Then, having looked up what I need to find out, I close the book. Now, this is our faith. I repeat, Vincent Ferrer was especially clear on the subtleties of pride. All I can tell you is one who is struggling with humility. All I can tell you, humility is a very hard virtue to develop. Because we call this self-complacency, most people would probably not even be quite sure how to spell the word. Does complacency have an S in it? No, it doesn't. But self-complacency means that I take unnecessary satisfaction in what either I've done or in what I am. Mirrors are a notorious object of self-complacency. Am I still making sense? That doesn't mean that I don't look into the mirror. It doesn't mean that I don't reflect on my good actions, say, to thank God for what he has done through this weak human creature. But all I can tell you is there is a difference between looking at self for the sake of enjoying self and looking at self because there is a good God-given reason for doing so. Somebody, I think, had a question. Oh.
If you think, say you're kind of discouraged with yourself, and then you, in order to get out of that, that would be
a legitimate reason. Because then, by implication, what you're trying to overcome is, as you say, the discouragement, which is, again, that's falsehood. Discouragement is a false humility. Just a moment. Genuine humility never overreaches itself, but it also never underreaches itself. Genuine humility never overestimates self, but it also never underestimates self. Now, if I am discouraged or despondent, I'm giving in to underestimation. So it makes sense to balance the budget. If all I see in my life is red, and I never see the other side of the ledger, it's no wonder some people get discouraged, which is one reason why I recommend to people in their daily examinations of conscience to always get into the habit of daily looking at the good things you've done with God's grace and, of course, humbly, the bad things. Thank God for the good things and ask his mercy for the bad. Now, avarice. Avarice has to do with material possessions. I think it is well to have these two in sequence, pride and avarice next, because all seven capital sins, as we call them, now my own sequence is PL, as you probably know, always second. But three, six, seven. Pride, avarice, lust, envy, anger. I usually use covetousness for avarice. It keeps me from repeating two A's in the same sequence. As, of course, is the notorious sloth, and gluttony is, well, gluttony. There's a seat right in front, if you don't mind. And bring, there are more seats. Come in, please. There's a chair right over there if you want to sit down. There's one over there. There's one back there, too, on the right. We're on the subject of the seven capital sins, and we are now on avarice. We just talked about pride. Now, avarice, otherwise known as covetousness, otherwise known as what?
Greed.
Synonyms. They have slightly different connotations, but essentially they mean the same thing. What I want to point out as we get into the seven capital sins, is that we have a fallen nature. Now, human nature is composed of body and soul. How much of our nature is fallen? The whole of it. We sometimes mistakenly identify concupiscence or passion with the flesh. We do have passions in the flesh, but the first and worst passions are in the spirit. And consequently, as between pride and avarice, pride is a passion of the spirit. And of what faculty of the spirit between mind and will? What would you say? It is of the will that Nietzsche calls the will to power, otherwise known as pride. The will to domination. And all other passions are subordinate to that one. Sometimes you wonder why people will slave for years. They've got all the money they need and more than they could possibly use. What's the reason? The lust for power. And it begins kind of early. I watched children. I did tell you, didn't I? About little Johnny, the son of his Episcopalian father, who has since entered the Catholic Church. I was having dinner with a family. They had little Johnny, I would say about 5 years old. Husband and wife, we were sitting down for dinner. Just before we sat down, Johnny picked up a deck of cards, which was on the windowsill, pulled out the cards, and smiled a wicked smile. The father said, "Johnny, put those cards back in the box." Johnny was holding on to the cards. "Put those cards back in the box." In a flash, he scattered. How many cards are there in a deck? 50?
52.
Two. He scattered the 52 cards over the dining room floor. What his father said, nobody but a man who has a master's degree in theology, which he did. That, he says, is original sin. Then the father said, "Well, Johnny, we'll have to wait with dinner until you pick up all the cards." Is that good training?
Yes.
So then we waited. Well, Johnny took him about 10 minutes to find all the 52, and some of them were missing. Now, Johnny wouldn't know how to spell avarice. He wouldn't know how to spell pride. But that is already human nature on its spiritual level of pride, right? In other words, we start very early. Do you know when we start acting up? Guess. Guess. What did you suggest? When do we start?
I said the crib.
Oh, before the crib.
Conception.
Some of you mothers.
Conception.
At conception. Don't babies act up before they're born?
Where is she?
In any case, the fallen human nature asserts itself in spirit and body very early. Avarice, then, belongs to the body. Pride belongs to the spirit. This is then an inordinate love or affection for anything material. Some people have the instinct stronger in them than others, but we all have it. And it's not so much how much you accumulate. It is the sheer possession. This is mine. What is the remedy for avarice? Well, just as with pride, what is the sovereign remedy for pride? Please? Humiliation. My day would be made. What's the sovereign, divinely instituted remedy for avarice? Remedy. Well, before you're generous, though, what must God do? See, He works at it. He doesn't leave it up to us. He doesn't trust us. He knows we're proud and He humiliates us. He knows we're greedy, avaricious, covetous, whatever word you want to use. And He does what? He what? Deprivation. Deprivation. Generosity is simply another word for self-deprivation. Generosity is self-deprivation with a smile. In other words, deprivation is being deprived of, right? And doesn't God do that very early in our lives? All right. All I know is that people who have not learned or have profited, not profited, from God's depriving them, they are really in a bad way. That's why I've always been so grateful for the poverty under which I was brought up. When I became a Jesuit, and I had to remind myself that I am entering a life of evangelical poverty, I've had much more. Once I enter the novitiate, than I ever had before I became a Jesuit. We had no car, no telephone. We seldom had a newspaper. I still remember, I think it's apropos, how many of you use canned milk? Oh, gee, thanks. I like to see I'm among kindred spirits. Do you sometimes use carnation milk?
Yes, yes.
Does it still have on the can, from contented cows? For years, I thought cows, especially if they were contented, gave canned milk. Deprivation. Well, the world calls perhaps the greatest evil, poverty. God honored by practicing from the moment He was born in a cave and then buried in a stranger's tomb. So the remedy for avarice is deprivation, whether imposed by God or imposed on self. What is lust? That's 88, 89, 90. I'd like to spend a little extra time on this subject. Lucille? Yes, we will go into some of that, too. Yes?
In regard to what you said, don't you think it depends on a person's own personality? I think we're all born with the being more weak in certain areas than others. Someone may be...
You are so right. Some of us, well, you just watch a child of three. Just. Infant pride. So, yes. Let's save this because I want to, it covers all the sins. The difference between mortal and venial sin and how, in the moral order, some general norms the Church gives us for distinguishing between the two. Okay. In general, lust is the inordinate or unruly, those are two synonymous words, desire for sexual pleasure. We begin by observing that there is a perfectly natural, normal, and lawful desire for sexual pleasure. If there wasn't, marriage would not be what God instituted it, both as a means of procreating the human race and then elevated it to a sacrament. However, as with all these desires, is it wrong to have to esteem ourselves? Is it wrong to recognize the good qualities we have? What is pride? Pride is the inordinate esteem of self. Is it wrong to desire to possess material things? No. In fact, we have one of the most important natural rights built on the desire to possess. What is that?
Private property.
Which communism denies. The right to private property. The right to private property is built on the desire to possess material things. Avarice comes from its being inordinate, where it's somehow out of control. So with lust. Lust is not sexual pleasure, even though we have come to practically identify sex with lust because so many people lack control until sexual desire out of control has almost become a synonym for sex. And psychiatrists will tell you, some at least, certainly Freud will, that the kind of control that Christianity requires of her followers is somehow psychotic. At any rate, the sexual desire is not lust. The lust is that desire out of control. Okay. Now, this one sin, we want to go into the gravity of it because it's such an important virtue, the opposite, chastity, to practice, that, as your answer gives you, lust of its very nature is a mortal sin. Therefore, any fully deliberate lustful desire, not sexual, but lustful desire, is a grave offense against God. Let's explain that in a little more detail. The sexual desire has been given to man by God in order to procreate the human race. Unless a husband and wife have the desire for sexual intercourse, children would not be conceived or born, and the human race would not survive. However, and this is the universal teaching, first of all, of right reason, and secondly, and for us more importantly, of the Church. The only condition, the only circumstance in which sexual desire may be legitimately gratified is within marriage. Nowhere else, nowhere else. By no one else, by no one else. Consequently, the first feature or description of what the word inordinate means is outside of marriage. Every, and this is the church's universal teaching, outside of marriage, every deliberate, even internal desire of a lustful nature, and it's lustful because it's outside of marriage, is thereby a sin, and if deliberately either aroused or indulged, is a grave sin. You will notice, otherwise than for the first two, and in fact for the others, lust is defined in terms of desire, because sins of lust are not only in the external order. Now you might say, well, we can commit sins of pride internally, right? We can commit sins of avarice internally. In fact, we have a special commandment of God for covetousness. Remember? The seventh commandment forbids us to what? To? Seventh to?
Steal.
And the tenth to what? To covet. We are forbidden to steal with our hands, and we're forbidden to steal with our hearts. The stealing with one's heart is otherwise known as covetousness. But moral theologians commonly, when they talk about lust, make sure they build right into the definition. Lust begins and can be gravely sinful, even though there is no external manifestation, whatever. When I lectured in the ancient religions, the Babylonian, Egyptian, and Jewish religions, apropos of whatever I was saying, I mentioned that Christ, when he came along, made sure that his followers would have no doubt that lust begins in the heart. That's why in the Sermon on the Mount, remember what he said? You've been told, if a man puts away his wife and marries another, commits adultery. But I tell you, if a man even looks lustfully at a woman, he commits what? Adultery with her in his heart. So following the teachings of Christ, all theologians make sure that while the heart is not brought out, the internal quality of the other six capital sins, though they can be committed internally, am I clear? But this one, so no one has any doubt, is spelled out. Lust is first committed in the heart. As a matter of fact, long before adultery has been committed in the flesh, adultery had been committed in the heart. In today's pansexual world, where everything practically stands or falls in the eyes of the world as good or bad, if it gives or fails to give sexual satisfaction. In this kind of a sex-mad world, there is no single vice or its correlative virtue that we need to know more about or stress more clearly than lust and its opposite, chastity. But now, when we talk about lust, remember, lust can be committed not only externally but internally. And we've got to keep emphasizing that. Because whatever can be true of other sins, external sins of lust begin inside. All of them, all of them, all of them, all of them. And that's the first self-control in this matter that must be practiced. Will I finish a little while? But while popularly or commonly we associate sins of lust, whether internal or external, with deliberately indulging sexual pleasure outside of marriage, is it possible to sin by lust even within marriage? Remember, this is where Pope John Paul created all kinds of negative reaction. Where I'm told in Italy, just about, well, every newspaper in Italy and throughout Europe and in the United States misquoting the Pope. Remember? How ridiculous they were saying can the Pope get? Whoever dreamt of sinning lustfully with one's own spouse? Well, just for the record, who remembers the name, the Latin title, of Pope Pius XI's famous encyclical on Christian marriage? Costi, do you remember how it's spelled? Costi, C-O-N-U-B-E. What does, these are both a genitive case, of or about. Chaste what? Connubium in Latin, it's a poetic word for marriage. The greatest single document published by the Holy See on marriage is called Chaste Marriage. And consequently, there are two forms of lust, not one. And the fact the Pope was so openly criticized and ridiculed and try to appear a fool is because he told the world that it's forgotten the meaning of chaste marriage. It is long ago forgotten chastity outside of marriage. It has now forgotten in large part chastity in marriage. What then is lust in marriage? There are two forms, two principal forms of lust in marriage. And they are infidelity and contraception. What are the two sins against chastity that the married can and sadly widely commit? They are infidelity and contraception. In other words, lust is not only a sin of the unmarried who must either wait until they get married or have control themselves outside of marriage, but even the married must remain chaste. He cannot say, I'm a married man, I have a right to marital or sexual intercourse. No, you don't. You have a right only to sexual intercourse with your wife, no one else. Can a married man sin gravely by having lustful thoughts about a woman who is not his wife? Yes. And when, as on occasion, I give men's retreats, depending on whom I'm giving the retreat to, and I talk about this subject, I tell them when I quote men who have told me, Father, you would think, you would know, not being a married man, you would think that women look attractive only until you get married, and then all your appeal is just for one woman, your wife. But as some men have told me, Father, you won't believe it. You won't believe it. For some men, other women begin to look more attractive. So lust is committed by the married, even in desire. And what bears all the emphasis we can give it, lust is committed by every act of contraception between the married. That's what the Pope was saying, and they tried to make him appear like a fool. Sexual pleasure in so many parts, especially of the Western world, has become an absolute. You get the pleasure at whatever cost, in whatever context, with whomsoever, and if no one else is around, with yourself. Well,
within marriage, and that's what I think he received the greatest criticism about.
Well, it's ultimately contraceptive, though. In other words, what the Pope was talking about, as you probably know, he'd been getting for weeks commentaries on the Book of Genesis, especially the first three chapters, in which marriage, the fall of man, original sin, and other aspects of man's origin are described in that first book of the Bible. What in context the Pope was talking about, he was talking about married people. But whether they are married or not, we must control this desire for sexual pleasure. And consequently, while let's call this marriage, and this is outside of marriage, pleasure. Now, within marriage, the only form of sexual pleasure that is legitimate is that which does not exclude possible conception, which in no way interferes with the life process. Now, modern psychology, or better, modern sexology, it's a science. Modern sexology has discovered all kinds of exotic ways of enjoying sex pleasure with increased intensity. And as one who has been teaching the Eastern religions for over 20 years, by the way, the past masters in erotic sex pleasure, the last word are the Orientals, at least some Orientals, for whom, as you know, sexual pleasure is one form of honoring their gods and goddesses. There was such a thing as temple prostitution. Now, because of my work, I've had to read some of these books in how sexual pleasure can be intensified. All I can tell you is that Freud was an amateur compared to some of these Orientals. What the Pope was talking about was that you are sinning by lust, whether you're alone or with somebody who is not your married partner or even your married partner. And he couldn't have made it stronger by emphasizing even with one's husband or wife. By enjoying pleasure, sexual pleasure, for itself. In God's design, sexual pleasure has a purpose. That purpose is always, always outside the pleasure and beyond the pleasure itself. If I deliberately exclude that purpose, then I sin by lust. Does that help, Doctor? And consequently, I don't even have to practice contraception. Now, you know, there are all kinds of erotic ways in which a married couple can indulge sexual pleasure. But always built into the lustfulness, and this is between the married people, will be the exclusion of the purpose for the sexual pleasure, which is the conception and procreation of children.
I wanted to ask you about the virtue of modesty. You know, is extremely lacking. I'm sure you would too. You know, and it seems to me that, female people of a female gender who want attention, this is their way, and they get instant gratification. Immodesty, okay? Now, it would seem to me that if a person wanted to preserve the virtue of purity, that they would guard their eyes, you know, and would not, and this, I think, would cut a lot of people off as far as getting the gratification that they want through immodest dress. And another thing I've observed is a lot of times girls that dress modestly, a lot of people, really good people, will drop careless remarks like, your skirt is too long, you look dowdy, this type of thing. And I really think they ought to be complimented that they have the courage.
Oh, yes. Well, we're going to... Thanks for raising the question, because there's no doubt. The lack of modesty, I think it's almost too weak a word. It's the loss of modesty. In some circles, it's simply an unknown word. Pornography. I live with Father Morton Hill. Some of you at least may know about him. He is the director of the Morality in Media, the largest organized effort to fight pornography in our country. He tells me that pornography in the United States is a multi-billion dollar trade. Some of the largest banks in the country invest millions in pornography. And it's getting worse. With cable television, it is now available. They now have television magazines for cable pornography. And our government He is in on it. And the politicians are profiting from it. Is Caligula being shown in Chicago? Is the movie Caligula being shown in Chicago? Well, I hate to say this. We can thank President Carter for Caligula. It was filmed in Italy at the cost of $17 million. It was brought to the United States. Every effort was made to keep it out of our country. It is 3 hours plus of total, complete nudity, bestiality, complete exposure, the most unnatural crimes, and the Carter administration and all the evidence that morality media have is that the federal government allowed it to come in and are now protecting those who are making millions on it. And the statement, I believe it is, that with Caligula now on the market, we might just as well erase all the pornography laws from our books. At any rate, I could tell you more. In fact, I'm going to be calling Rome tomorrow morning in connection with Caligula, because I've been asked to do so, trying to make a last desperate effort to keep it, not out of the United States, but it's here, but at least to send it back to where it came from. In any case, your modesty that you're talking about, God help America, because there's so much money being made on arousing sex passion. Listen.
The talk that you referred to by Pope John Paul regarding Genesis are being compiled in book form by the Daughters of St. Paul, but they aren't ready yet.
Well, I would hope so. What the Pope said is simply common Catholic knowledge. The trouble is, so many, even among Catholics, don't realize how grave the sin is and how grave is the obligation to preserve the virtue. I might mention just in passing, one of the great influences in my life was St. Alphonsus Liguori, the founder of the Redemptorists, wrote a shelf of books, the church's official patron of spiritual directors and confessors, the father of Catholic moral theology. Here is one of his statements I've not forgotten. Most souls in hell are there because of sins against the sixth and ninth commandments. In any case, I think it's 2:15, isn't it? And we should have a break. Let's make a symbolic sign of the cross. What time did we begin?
1:00.
It's 2:15. We will continue after our break in the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Amen. To what time do I go now?
3:00 on this, or say 10 after.
Bill Mormon just reminded me that much of the criticism in the papers of what the Pope said was over his use of the word adultery. Mm-hmm. Now, the biblical meaning of adultery is any kind of lustful desire or action. Porneia, the Greek word, does not mean merely adultery in our sense of sexual relations with someone who is not your spouse. However, the basic concern of the Pope was to make sure that we recognize that lust can be committed also by people who are married and even between themselves. In terms of the remedies for lust that you have in question 90, let me just stress what I think needs more emphasis than we commonly give it. Since these seven capital sins, as we call them, are seven manifestations of our fallen human nature, what we need to keep telling ourselves is that since man has fallen, there is no natural way in which these sinful desires or passionate urges, all seven, can be controlled by mere human nature. When we speak of Christ as having redeemed the world, meaning that he has merited the grace of our salvation, the grace we merit is the grace to overcome the sinful instincts or desires, and consequently, anything that will obtain grace is necessary in order to overcome whatever the concupiscence may be, in this case, lust. All the stoic self-control, all the practical austerity that a person may practice, nothing is sure to control the lustful impulse ultimately except grace. And consequently, to obtain the grace, I need to use the means of grace, which are mainly prayer and the sacraments. 91, 92, and 93 through 94 have to do with envy. The essence of envy, unlike avarice, is not that I necessarily desire to obtain what someone else possesses. Envy is rather the sadness, the disappointment that I experience over someone having or enjoying what I lack. Notice the difference between avarice and envy. In both cases, the self lacks what another has. In avarice, I lack what someone has. In envy, I lack what someone has. But when I'm covetous or avaricious, I desire to obtain what belongs to another without paying for it. In other words, it is the unjust desire to possess what another has. Avarice is really a passion of the body. Envy is much worse. When I envy, somebody has something that I don't have. And if you can believe it, I don't want to get it. The person has something which, because he or she has it, I am disappointed. I'm sad. In other words, where avarice is really a sin against justice, envy is a sin against charity. Am I clear? Now, envy is much more common than avarice. In fact, I believe among the passions to which we are all naturally prone, the most universal and the hardest to eradicate, and I believe the last one, the last passion, to be totally controlled, even by the saints, is envy. Why should that be? By the way, you'll notice I am not directly addressing myself to your questions and answers. You get it? I assume you've got them there, and I want to kind of embellish or amplify what's there. Envy is a sin against charity, because what's wrong with envy is not the more human, though still sinful, desire to possess what somebody else has by taking it away without either working or paying for it, or having the person give it to me and asking for it. In envy, there is no desire to acquire. As a matter of fact, listen to this. The person who has what I don't have couldn't possibly give it to me, or I couldn't possibly possess it. I can envy what I could never obtain. Does that still make sense?
Not to me.
You'll have to go into this a little further. I don't think.
In other words, people may have what couldn't possibly be shared with anybody. The simplest, of course, is she's 20 or 30 years younger than me. There is nothing under heaven I can do to change my age. And the things that go with youth that older people tend to envy. Moreover, and this is the most serious part, avarice has to do with material possessions. Envy may involve material things, but envy is worst when what somebody else has that I lack is spiritual. I can envy a person's possession of virtue. I can envy a person's ability to pray. I can envy a person's sanctity. I am notoriously unholy. The other person is obviously closer to God, practices virtue that I don't. The most important document in the first century outside of the Bible, which was finished by the end of the first century, is the first letter of Pope Clement to the Corinthians. It is not part of the Bible, but it is a letter quite long and very pointed. The whole letter of Pope Saint Clement happens to be the first, date about 90 AD. Pope Saint Clement wrote to the Corinthians telling them that they should beware of the temptation to envy. He wrote to the priests in Corinth who were envying the bishops. And his whole letter, it's a long one, shows how envy is at the root of all the problems that have faced the world from the dawn of history to his day. He begins by pointing out that the first murder was committed by whom killing whom?
Cain
killed Abel. So Cain and here. During the long centuries after the beginning of the human race, up to the time of Christ, we are told that many of the faithful servants of God were opposed and even assaulted, and some of them killed. For example, the prophets. It was mainly out of envy. So the whole Old Testament is filled with all sorts of crimes of envy. Remember the conflict between David and Saul, remember? Where Saul tried to kill David, remember? On account of envy. But the big one came with Christ. Why did the scribes and Pharisees hound Christ until finally they had him unjustly condemned to death and crucified him?
They claimed that he was plotting against them. That they were.
But what? Now I'm quoting this. Pope Clement the First.
They wanted to be Christ-like.
It was envy. Christ succeeded where they failed. Christ had thousands following him. And the most serious thing, which the Pharisees, scribes, and Sadducees envied in Christ was his holiness. As I think I've mentioned, perhaps to this class, when we begin in the novitiate, then we have 2 years of study afterwards, and we're subjected every Sunday to two sermons. The young man trying out to begin to preach. I must have heard, maybe 300 sermons every Sunday. One sermon I've never forgotten. The young scholastic got up, and we were all eating at table, which is very hard to pay attention to a homily while you're eating. He began his sermon with this question: who do you think is the most unpopular person on a college campus? We thought that's a strange way of starting a sermon, but we stopped eating to get the answer. So he said, the most unpopular person on the college campus is the girl who has just won the popularity contest. Does that make sense? Whatever else I can tell you this. The price of success is envy. And it can penetrate and infect the most intimate relationships between husband and wife, brother and sister, intimate friends. Because envy, as we've been saying, is a failure in charity. The real test of genuine love is when I am, as far as it is humanly possible, as happy over someone else's possessing what I lack or succeeding where I have failed. Then you are a real disciple of Christ. I've given too many papers back to too many students, and I always put the papers upside down, not to reveal the grade, all that the person behind has to get is a C. You get an A. It is very difficult for the one with a C not to be sad that the other got an A.
Well,
notice, we're saying that envy is the sadness that I experience, and sadness is wrong. It may be that if I see someone have what I don't have, I may be, and this is not splitting hairs, I may be sorrowful. But I'm not sad, because if someone else has something that I could have, maybe should have, that person's possessing what I lack, maybe the stimulus I need to emulate. Two words you should always keep together: envy and emulation. Emulation is the desire to obtain what another person has that I lack, but using legitimate means. It is neither greed nor envy. Does that help? But envy, let me tell you, as one who has dealt with so many souls, I believe can poison the relationship between even the most intimate friends. In any case, envy is especially opposed to charity. Let's look at 94 for just a moment, please. Just a moment, honey. What are some remedies against envy? Evidently and mainly, the practice of fraternal charity. Just to refresh my memory, have we gone over faith, hope, and charity already?
No.
Then I won't spoil by...
On the quiz.
Please?
It should be on the quiz.
Oh, well. It probably is. But I would say, if I can get into the habit of not looking at what people have that I lack, but watch this, and this is not a clever phrase, but get into the habit of looking to what people lack that I have, that's the root of charity. What do people lack? What do they need that I can somehow give them? All uncharitable people are envious people. And the more generous I am, the more generous I am in finding out what another person needs, and even if I don't have it, that I try to acquire it in order that I might share, the less liable I am to be affected by the demon of envy. In fact, just a moment, Pope Clement pushes the sin of envy not only to the beginning of the human race. This is the origin of man, where envy between human beings, but How did our first parents first fall? Through temptation by the evil spirits. Why did the devil tempt Eve? Through envy. He had lost what he saw man being destined to achieve. The first sin of the devil against man is envy, the source of all the diabolical temptations to which we are subject. They are all due to the devil's envy. Where, in other words, did man learn to envy his fellow man? From the devil. But the Pope pushes this one step further. No rational creature has ever been made by God without God's demanding that rational person somehow earn their heavenly reward. Before God made mankind, he made the angels. Some, we believe, fell. The angels, therefore, became the good and, as we say, the bad angels. How do the angels who fell get that way? They sinned. What sin do they commit? But pride as what? Whom, watch this, whom do the angels who became demons, whom do they envy?
God.
That's why who is like hell? Who is like God? And that's why the root of all of our sins, though we seldom thus analyze them, we envy God's happiness, having everything he wants and needs, and depending on no one, but we depend absolutely on him. In other words, envy is not as trivial or passing a sin as might meet the eye. Envy is historically at the root of all sin, from the fall of the angels, through the fall of man, through all the sins that man has committed ever since. In other words, when we talk about remedies against envy, it is practicing charity not only towards our fellow man, but the main reason we should practice, what a strange expression, charity towards God, which St. Augustine defines. The love of God, he says, is not envying the Almighty. Does that make sense?
Are those two of them closely related, pride?
Of course, of course, of course. Mary?
The difference between envy and, like, say, jealousy.
Yes.
And the jealousy is sadness or fear of another obtaining what we already have, as opposed to what we don't have, like envy.
Well, jealousy, unlike envy, in both cases, there is a bad relationship between myself and my neighbor.
Now, again, self and the other. Envy and jealousy.
When I envy, I lack what another has. Okay? When I'm jealous, I have what I don't want to share. My neighbor lacks, and I don't want to share and supply for his need. Right. Between the two, envy is still the worst sin. Because when I'm jealous, I have something that if I were charitable, I'd be willing to share. And there's an understandable human weakness that it's mine. But when I envy, the incredible thing is I don't have it. And you think I'd be satisfied with not having. Yes?
Now, Father, you talked about generosity as being, the cure for this.